Time is 9:03 a.m. Welcome to the coffee table. I'm Kathleen Gustafson, and in the studio this morning, it is Homer Volunteer Fire Department Chief Bob Painter. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm so glad you could be here. We've been reading information from the Volunteer Fire Department, so I wanted to make sure to get you in here in advance of all the things you have going on right now. It's just like everywhere else, it's summer at the fire station. So the first thing I would really like to talk a little bit about, if you could give us just a brief history of the fire department and the building. I even have my Citizens Academy materials here that I could probably follow along.
As well as I'm able to, that definitely predates my arrival in Homer in 1991. The fire department was established by local citizens in 1952. And in 1954, they incorporated as Homer Volunteer Fire Department, incorporated as a nonprofit organization. And they continued to operate that way until 1990, when they entered into agreement with the city of Homer to take over full operation and financing of the fire department. And the Volunteer Corporation transferred all of its assets, including the building on Pioneer, the apparatus, except for a couple of the older apparatus that they had emotional attachments to.
Wait, so you mean like groovy old fire trucks? emotional attachments?
Well, the first fire truck that Homer had, which we call Engine 1, we still have. It's a 1946 Willys Jeep. And it's equipped with a front mount PTO pump, and that would pump water. It pulled a trailer behind it that carried about 300 gallons of water, and it had hose and firefighting hand tools, and that was Homer's first fire engine.
And these days it makes appearances in parades?
As it's able to. Yeah, it's showing its age like a lot of us, but it we try to get it out when it's able to. Right now it's stored up at our Skyline station. And it was lovingly restored by a volunteer back in the 80s to its current condition. And we'd like to try to keep that up and maintain it as well as we can.
Well, terrific. Now, but first, could you tell me a little more? I didn't realize that you just got here in the 90s, because you have always been the voice of the fire department since I've been in town, since 2000. So can you tell me a little bit about your experience and your work before you came to the Homer Fire?
Sure. I came to Homer in the summer of 1991 to take the job as assistant chief over the Emergency Medical Services Program. And I worked with a great bunch of people, Robert Purcell, the fire chief then, Elaine Grabowski, who just retired last year from the fire department after 34 years. She's still responding as a volunteer. Before I came to Homer, I was the assistant director of emergency medical services for a small community in Oklahoma about the size of Homer called Collinsville. I was a paramedic and EMT paramedic there. I also volunteered for our local fire department for 6 years, working from a volunteer up to a volunteer assistant chief position with the fire department there. And when I answered a job advertisement for the assistant chief in Homer and came up for an interview process and assessment center, and they offered me the position, and I accepted and came up in 1991. And the end of 1999, the chief then, Robert Purcell, decided to retire, and I became chief in 2000 and have been chief since then.
Ever since.
Yeah, ever since. So I've got a little over 26 years with the city of Homer as assistant chief and fire chief, and other duties as assigned, such as the director of emergency services for the city, which means I'm basically the emergency manager for the city of Homer as well, overseeing disaster preparedness and planning.
And we are going to move on to some other topics, but before we do, I want people to know that the phone lines are open. If you have a question or a comment for Homer Volunteer Fire Department Chief Bob Painter, call in at 235-7721 or 1-800-979-5224. Or if you don't feel like talking on the telephone, you can email questions to kathleen@kbbi.org. And I would love to hear from some people who have taken the fire department training, who have served with the fire department as an EMT or a firefighter or in any other capacity, because Bob Painter, you have a drill coming up on Saturday, and we might be able to get a few more people involved in it just by talking about it today. Can you set it up for me?
Absolutely. Every third year, the airport in Homer, which is operated by the State of Alaska Department of Transportation, for FAA accreditation, they have to have a full-scale airplane crash exercise. And this year, we've expanded that to include participation by the hospital, Sildovia Village Tribe Clinic, Raven Aviation, FedEx, some of the other players, Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management. And this exercise is being conducted Saturday morning at the airport. And we are going to, we're still needing probably about 10 what we call role players, volunteer actors, for want of a better word, that will participate as victims for this airplane crash, that we will we'll meet at the airport, and then we will triage, which means sort based on severity, and transport patients to the appropriate medical facility at that time. And then those medical facilities will then continue the simulated treatment of the patients until just to exercise their own individual in-house plans. So the hospital is activating their mass casualty plan and mass fatality plan. Sildovia Village Tribe Clinic is the first year that they participated in. It's our goal to kind of eliminate some of the overcrowding or dumping every patient at the hospital. So our plan is to transport what we call walking wounded or the minor injured patients to the clinic for evaluation.
And is that something? Is that something you came up with based on previous drills?
It's just something when you only have one medical facility or one hospital to transport everybody to. We needed to find some way to eliminate the patient load of that receiving facility. So we have some very good clinics in town that we can transport patients to that don't require maybe hospitalization or surgery or that level of care, that can take care of the minor scrapes and bruises, maybe even fractures temporarily until the hospital's overwhelming influx of patients is somewhat relieved. So that's what we're going to test with this exercise. We have a couple of folks coming down from the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management that are going to operate as evaluators for the exercise. So we'll get some independent feedback on how we do, how well we do, if we have any gaps in our coverage or any suggestions of how we can improve service to the community. But that's one way that the community can participate in this exercise, is call me at the fire station that you got from Bush Line. Yeah, 235-3155. And I'm at extension 1, but you can leave a message. If I don't answer, you can leave a message with my phone or anybody there. Leave a contact number, and I'll be happy to call you back and get you on the list.
Well, getting people to call a phone number, 10 people in an hour, that's something public radio does. We do that. So I just want to encourage anyone who's listening, if you, it's your Saturday, and if you'd like to spend it in service to the community and meet all kinds of people, it should be like, there should be, I'm guessing, how many people involved?
Well, we're hoping to have about 35 to 40 people involved in the exercise, both as simulated patients and maybe family members or distraught people that are waiting at the airport for the incoming plane, as they would be.
Right, trying to set up every group that would be...
Trying to set up victim groups or victims' family groups that would have obviously be there in a real plane crash that will basically act as role players in the event outside of being a victim for the plane crash. But we still need victims for the plane crash as well.
All right, LARPers, I am looking at you. If you are a live-action role player up at the park, think about spending this Saturday live-action role-playing an emergency response. And that number is 235-3155. Extension 1 is Chief Bob Painter. And you can leave a message. And let's see if we can't accomplish that today, getting 10 more people to be a part of that exercise. I want to ask a little more about it. what would a person who shows up to volunteer expect? When they call, will you get back to them and give them a role to be ready for when they arrive?
Basically, when they call, I just get them on the roster. I really don't want people just to show up Saturday morning unannounced.
Yes.
Because I want to actually have you be able to do something. And if we get too many people, I can't get everybody involved. But we need, 35, maybe 40 people involved in the exercise. I've got about 20 right now that are confirmed. But even those, I understand things come up. So if
right.
they don't show up, they don't show up. So I'd rather have too many than too few. So if you can participate. So what's going to happen is people are going to be at the airport fire station, which is off Kachemak Drive, just past Smoky Bay Air on the left as you're going east on Kachemak Bay Drive. And we will get a waiver signed by folks. If you're a minor, you're welcome to participate with parental permission or a legal guardian. And we have a couple of folks that are going to be there providing what's called moulage, and that is makeup. So we will be simulating
injuries. There's something for every interest.
There's something
exercise.
For every interest. So if you have an interest in theatrical makeup or whatever, you want to come help out, that's
scars
really something
and blood
to do.
And all the fun stuff for theatrical makeup.
Injuries, bruises, cuts, abrasions, all that kind of stuff.
Practice your black eye technique.
Black eyes, yeah. I mean, they don't show up immediately, but we can make them look like early black eyes. But that's part of it. A lot of people enjoy that role-playing and getting out of a typical role and playing a victim for a few hours. And we're hopefully, when we get the thing started between 9 and 9:30 tomorrow, that once we get them transported up to the hospital or the clinic, that maybe another hour and a half, we're hoping folks will be done by noon, and we'll be happy to provide transportation back from wherever we dropped you off, back to the airport so you can pick up your vehicles. Folks could carpool or something like that, or maybe have somebody meet them at the hospital. That's fine too. We just want to account for everybody that's participating so we know where you ended up, so we don't lose anybody, that you're okay and you're done with the exercise and can go about the rest of your, hopefully maybe a sunny afternoon.
Right. And so I just want to repeat that back. If anybody's thinking, oh, I can't volunteer and lose my whole Saturday, you're done around noon.
I'm hoping folks are done around noon. Now, we're going to be participating. Our emergency operations center for the city is actually going to set up this time in our alternate EOC because our fire station is undergoing renovation right now, if you haven't noticed. We sure have in the building. And we're going to set up at city council chambers, and we're going to have an alternate EOC with minimally staffed EOC because it's a fairly small event. It's localized. It's a small event. We don't expect to have our EOC up for more than a few hours. But we're trying to make this a larger scale drill than we have in the past years.
Well, I think KBBI has a part to play in that. Not that we would broadcast it, but we have an antenna. We have a link to city council. We could record that and give it back to you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that way, just to test that we are ready to go to air.
In a normal event, when our normal EOC, which is a fire station, is operable, the plan is that we would use council chambers as a joint information center because it is set up with radio
we
communications.
We can go directly
already.
To air, yeah.
So.
Also, I know our KBBI News Director, Aaron Bolton, has expressed interest in being there to cover it because that would also be what would be happening during a drill. I mean, during
for sure.
And
I've invited the media to participate in instead of and a little bit deeper than they would normally be allowed scene entrance because the airport is a secure facility. Providing them with identification so they can kind of get behind the scenes or more of an embedded reporter situation where they can get better information and some close-ups and interaction with what's going on the scene versus being back behind the fire line, so to speak, or behind the fences getting information.
And is there anything else you can think of that people would need to know? So if you're coming to participate, I'm thinking comfortable shoes, layers, bottle of water, energy bar.
We'll have, I'm sure we'll have some snacks and water at the airport. But once the event starts, we ask people, dress for the weather. Dress like you would be if you're taking a flight. Don't dress up. And if you have if you're participating in the exercise as a role player, wear old clothing or maybe something that you don't mind if it gets stained or ruined, because sometimes the fake blood that we use,
that's right, there
if
will
we
be
use
blood.
Fake blood,
yes.
Stains. So, and we may have some zealous medical providers that maybe want to remove your clothing to assess you properly. So if you wear a bathing suit underneath your clothing, that's maybe a good idea too, unless you want to shock everybody, or we have had that in the past where role players have just worn normal underwear underneath mm-hmm. their clothing. And when we expose them as part of the patient assessment, we get shocked and they get kind of a chuckle out of it. But wear clothing appropriate for the day. It could
layers
be rainy, it could be cool. It is August in Alaska, so, and you're probably going to be you're going to be outside for some time until we get you packaged and transported to the hospital. But that typically happens in past events. We get everybody transported within 45 minutes to an hour. We're going to have more victims this year than we've ever had before, since Raven is flying only Dash aircraft into Homer now.
Mm-hmm.
We could have 30, 35 patients on board a fully loaded Dash between passengers and crew. So
I was just about to ask how this has changed over years.
Yeah, it's just gotten bigger. We have to. The airport has to have at least 20 simulated injuries to comply with their FAA requirements. So we're going to fill up a simulated Dash with simulated patients. Now, some of those are going to be fatal, because the hospital also wants to exercise their mass fatality plan. So we're going to be having enough fatalities from the event that we'll actually be using mannequins, inflatable mannequins for that. We don't want somebody to have to play dead for 2 or 3 hours, although that's a role that I could even do. But we'll use inflatable mannequins for the fatality injuries, fatal injuries. And then we can deal with those after we transport all of the viable patients from the scene. We're not only doing this alone, we're also partnering with our other South Peninsula providers. Anchor Point Volunteer Fire Department, Katzmack Emergency Services will be responding personnel and ambulances to help us, as they would normally, and as they have in the past, to make this happen.
And after the exercise is over, what kind of procedure do you go through for compiling and presenting what your findings?
Well, we have what's called a hot wash or a debrief after the event for the providers, for the responders, for the instant command staff, and for the EOC personnel. We'll get feedback from the state evaluators, and we'll put that into what's called an after action report that'll identify any gaps in our existing system, things that we did good, things that we did that weren't so good, and things that we need to improve on.
So I'm going to say one more time before we move on. If you are someone, let's say you're someone who wants to serve the community, who doesn't? But the idea of reading a city council packet just fills you with dread. Here's something you can do in one afternoon, in one morning.
In a morning.
In
yeah.
one day, and be of immense service to the community, really contribute, by calling the Homer Volunteer Fire Department 235-3155, extension 1, and volunteering for the emergency response drill this weekend. What are you calling it?
It's an airport disaster exercise.
Airport disaster exercise. So that's fire and EMT.
Right.
And I have a few more things on my list, but I want to make sure from you that you feel like we've covered everything people need to know about this drill. Will there be sirens going off?
Because it is an exercise, we're not going to let our emergency vehicles run red lights and sirens just as a safety measure. So we build that time into the exercise. Instead of having Anchor Point and Katzmack responding from their various locations, red lights and siren, we're probably going to pre-stage them at the Homer station and then just time delay them, normal time delays, like 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes for different responses, depending on where they're coming from. So we don't want to put anybody at risk. So our response times are going to be somewhat delayed, but it is a small town. You know, from the airport to the hospital is just a few miles. So we'll build that into the exercise, where we'll subtract those delayed. Running red lights and siren buys us another maybe 30 seconds to a minute responding from the airport. So if you see a bunch of ambulances running around town Saturday morning, fire engines, that's what it's all about. But we're not going to be running red lights and sirens.
Good to know. So are you ready to move on from that topic?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do it. I heard you mention, I know that you have firefighter training coming up soon. And how's that class filling up?
Soon. I can't give you numbers right now. We're still recruiting.
You have room.
We'll be recruiting. We are always recruiting for new volunteers, whether you want to be a volunteer emergency medical technician, a volunteer firefighter, or both. Our next class coming up is a firefighter recruit class, and this is State of Alaska Firefighter Level 1. We're doing a combined joint class with Anchor Point. It'll be starting on October 2nd, and classes will be every Monday night, every Wednesday night from 6 until 10, and then Saturdays from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. Classes will be spread out between Homer and Anchor Point. So,
at the fire station?
They'll be at the Anchor Point Fire Station or at the Homer Fire Station or down at our live fire training facility on the Homer Spit. So the classes are mixed up. You'll have a wide range of instructors from Homer and Anchor Point. And we've done this for the last several years, and it's really helped with the joint training's really helped with the knowledge of how other departments operate. Everybody doesn't do everything exactly the same way every time, and it allows us to integrate and know what the other departments are operating and to see the other members of the other departments as they train. And it just helps with the camaraderie when we do mutual aid with these other departments, which is very common, very frequently. We're all fairly small departments, and when we have a large fire where we need a lot of people, we're constantly using each other's resources to make it safe for everybody and to make the biggest impact on the event, whether it's a fire or a large EMS call like the plane crash exercise coming up.
And if anyone who is listening has ever taken that training and served as a firefighter or EMT, I would invite you to call and make your pitch to convince people to serve the community in this way. That number is 235-7721, and that's KBBI. Or you could email us at kathleen@kbbi.org. The next question I have for you is, what kind of overlap in terms of the training for EMT and firefighter? Is EMT also held at the fire station? Or is do you work with the college on that?
We do work with the college. All of our classes we broker through the university. So if you take one of our classes, firefighter or EMT, you can get college credit for those classes. For the EMT class, it's now, I believe, 6 credit hours of college. For the firefighter one, because it's such a long, in-depth class, you can get up to 12 college credits for taking State of Alaska Firefighter 1. And we do broker those, so those classes are available. And we've worked with Carol Schwartz at the college since I've been here for 26 years. We've collaborated with the college and offering different classes throughout the year. We typically do one firefighter class a year and one EMT class a year just to get new people into the department, because we're, unfortunately, being a volunteer department, we have a pretty high attrition rate. People come into the community, they take the training, and maybe they leave, or they can't find employment or proper housing, so they have to leave the community. Or they,
have a hard enough time finding DJs that can stay. I can imagine you have that issue.
And sometimes we run into the volunteer that they take the class and they end up liking it so much, they like what they do and the training, that they want to go on and make it a career. And unfortunately, we only have 6 paid positions in the city of Homer, including our newly hired assistant chief.
What are those 6 positions?
Myself,
chief and assistant chief.
Chief, assistant chief, departmental services coordinator, which acts as my administrative assistant and kind of our overall administrative assistant. And we have 3 paid firefighter EMT3s that work 1 day on, 2 days off.
Well, Katie is on line 1.
This is Katie Olson.
Katie Olson, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
I just was responding to what I just happened to turn on the radio and hear that you're taking on volunteers, which I noticed. I wanted to say, first of all, I'm 80 now, but I started out as a firefighter in California and continued on in Girdwood as a volunteer, and that was really, really a neat thing. I came to realize that I didn't have the upper body strength you might need in a glaciated area, so I went into CPR and EMT. I would say to you and to all people out there, go ahead and throw yourselves into it if you can. The training itself still works for me. There hardly is a week goes by, something doesn't come up that I'm aware of that I can act on, and maybe just a small way, but it really, really pays off, and it's always there. It's just invaluable training.
Well, thanks, Katie Olson. Do you want to respond to that, Chief Painter?
No, I when I started in this business 38 years ago, it started as a volunteer, and as Katie said, you know, everywhere I go, everything that I do, the training, I got involved in the training because when I was commuting back and forth to college on weekends, going home on weekends, I had about a 90-mile drive. And invariably, I'd come across an accident or something that I felt helpless. So I took an EMT class so I could actually maybe stop and help out. And that's kind of started my whole career in EMS. Started as an EMT, then a paramedic, and then joined the volunteer fire department, and continued on with both my formal and vocational education, and have enjoyed every minute of it. It's great when, you know, I don't go to work every day. I go to my job, and it's something I enjoy doing.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for calling.
You're so welcome, and thank you for your good show.
Sure thing. Bye-bye. And there's a lot of... I have the Citizens Academy packet, the chapter on the Homer Fire Department here. And this is from a couple of years ago, and I'm looking at... I'll hand it over to you. The cost of outfitting an EMT and the cost of outfitting a firefighter. Because as you were discussing, talking about the classes... So are those classes must cost money. Does the city budget cover those?
It does, yeah. We don't charge anything to the student taking the class, but it is expensive, and it hasn't gotten any less expensive over the last couple of years since you took the Citizens Academy.
Right.
We have to, by NFPA, National Fire Protection Association regulation or standard, and OSHA standards and other requirements, we have to provide certain levels of safety and protection. And just outfitting a new firefighter with protective gear, providing initial physical examinations and verification that they're physically able to do the class and to be a firefighter or an EMT cost a lot of money. And we asked in return of the volunteer is that they provide us at least a year of volunteer service.
So is there a contract to that effect?
Basically, we asked them to sign a letter of commitment that they'll, over the next 15 months, they'll give us 12 months of active participation. And we do have them sign a promissory note that will basically say if they are unable to do that or fulfill that, then they'll pay a portion of what it costs for the training. I believe it's $750 for a firefighter class and $500 for an EMT class.
And can you go down a little bit of what it takes to outfit an EMT and what it takes to outfit a firefighter?
Okay, what we look at for firefighter per individual, we've got obviously the class, which is around 200 hours, 250 hours by the time it's all said and done between firefighter one, hazardous material operations, incident command, all that. It comes to about 280 hours. With the instructor time and everything else, that's about $9,000. Firefighter One, a textbook for Firefighter One and Hazmat, is over $200 now for a set of books per individual. CPR certification, just the card alone, is $3.25. The state testing fee for firefighter is $25. Annual physicals cost us between $750 to $1,200 per individual for the annual physical. Hepatitis A and B vaccinations that are required that we offer to the volunteers cost, the series costs $650. They're equipped with a pager, a radio, another $2,000. What we call turnout or our protective clothing, the pants and the coat that we wear, there's another $2,000 there. Boots, $190 to $350, depending on the style of boot. set of gloves, extrication gloves, firefighting gloves, a helmet, lights, helmet flashlights, Nomex hood, glasses, pocket tools, everything else, comes to about $22,000 per firefighter when they're equipped to go into a working structure fire. Now, you know, air packs and things that are reusable and everything, you know, a lot of this stuff is reusable. But that's what the typical firefighter is, between $22,000 and $25,000 of equipment that they're wearing or have used in training or in their medical evaluations.
And do the firefighters and EMTs go through de-escalation training? They're often first on the scene in some pretty hairy circumstances.
There is a program. We do have a critical incident stress management program, and there are members in the community that are trained as debriefers. We do work with community mental health. We also have resources throughout the state that if we don't have a local debriefer available, our team of debriefers available to diffuse or debrief an event that's traumatic to the crews, such as a mass casualty event that's coming up as an exercise. We can call the state, and the state will send people to Homer to help us out. You know, we're very good at providing protection for ourselves, and it's, you know, we always look at, you know, that we protect our own, we guard our own. So we do have those services available. I can make a phone call.
And you have good support from the state.
Within 2 days, I'll have a team down here to help my crews deal with the emotional trauma of dealing with what they've dealt with.
Now, we're going to take a short break, just a little 5-minute break. And when we come back, oh, there's still half a list of things here to talk about. But the last question I want to ask you is, I was making a joke, a silly joke, when you were here before we went on the mic, because it's so overcast and rainy today. I said, when you wake up and there's rain coming down and everything is wet, do you just relax a little bit? And you said, absolutely not. No, never. So what do you do, and what do you recommend that firefighters and EMTs do to decompress? Well, I know you have a gym, right? In the
we have a small gym. We also provide our volunteers with a shared cost of membership to a health club or like the Alaska gym or the Bay Club, things like that. That help. Exercise is a good de-stressor. Some of us need more exercise than others.
And I imagine, well, that's what Katie Olson, the caller, talked about. Mm-hmm. Upper body strength is key. I mean, I realize it's the whole body, but upper body strength is very important in what you do.
I think the most important strength that a firefighter EMT has is the upper body, the top of the body, the brain. Because we can think ourselves out of a lot of situations, but you've got to have at least a physical strength to do the job, whether it's upper body, lower body. EMTs do a lot of lifting, a lot of bending, and sometimes patients don't avail themselves to proper lifting techniques. So one of the biggest things that EMTs hurt are backs and knees.
People aren't always behaving the way you would hope they would.
Well, they don't end up in the best
or their bodies can't
position
behave.
Sometimes.
Right.
So, you know, in bathrooms, which has limited space, or we're in a vehicle providing patient care during an extrication. And you imagine the vehicle's already damaged. It's already crumpled up. We have patients, 1, 2, 3, 4 people. And then we have to climb in and contort ourselves to help care for the patients that are in the vehicle. So it's not always conducive to the best body mechanics in the world. So we suffer back and strains, muscle strains, that type of thing. That goes with the job. The mental health is something that we try to deal with or address through debriefing, diffusing, or other things that are necessary. We tell people, you know, do not be hesitant to let us know if you're having issues or problems. You know, everybody does. And suicide among emergency providers, unfortunately, is similar to that of soldiers and returning veterans. It's high, and we need to address that as a whole, as a group, as an organization, to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Well, you've been listening. You are listening to The Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890 Homer. The time is 9:38. Chief Bob Painter from the Homer Volunteer Fire Department is in the studio. I'm Kathleen Gustafson, and we're going to take 5. Chief Bob Painter from the Homer Volunteer Fire Department is in the studio. Welcome back to the coffee table. And while we had the mics off for just a minute, we spoke a little bit about, so let's say you can't, you personally listening, can't really put in the time and commit to a year on the Homer Volunteer Fire Department, but you want to know what the fire department would like you to know in case you witness an emergency or you see something. Like, how are the ways that people can just be helpful?
I think the first thing is notify us if you see something that's not normal. You see an accident. If people could just, if you feel safe to do so, pull out of the way, stop. And ask if there's any injuries, things that we want to know, things that we ask our dispatcher. Are there any injuries? Is there anybody that's trapped in the vehicle? Is the vehicle on fire? Things that we need to know to respond properly, whether respond a rescue truck, a fire engine, or just an ambulance to a motor vehicle crash. We get a lot of calls from people that just, they'll see an accident, they'll use their cell phone, they'll call in, and they keep going down the road on their merry way and without providing any follow-up. So we have to send an officer or call the troopers to respond. And sometimes that just delays care because they want to make sure that, there is somebody in the vehicle, there's somebody injured, and we need the fire department, whether it's Anchor Point or Homer or Katchimack Emergency Service Area, depending on where the accident is. So just getting as much information as you can. Same way with a fire. If you see a fire, call 911. Don't think that somebody else called it in because you saw it. Somebody else may have not seen it yet, but call, give us as much information as you can. It's a two-story house and I see flames coming out the window. I see smoke. We get a lot of smoke calls, especially in the summertime. People are burning slash burns or controlled burns. So first thing the dispatcher does when they get a call is they look at their active burn list and see whether somebody's burning. Now, if you see white smoke, it's often just a controlled burn. But if you see black, gray smoke, it's often a structure or something else burning. So those are a little bit more problematic for us to find out about. But as much information as you can provide the dispatchers, and all of our dispatchers and the dispatchers in Soldotna on 911 are all trained as emergency medical dispatchers. They're all very well trained. And they take the information that you provide them and they share that with us so we can better prepare on the way there and what resources we send to the call. So just providing good information is key to getting the proper help as quickly as possible to the people in need.
So while your mic was failing and I was putting a new one on you, I my attention dropped on what you were saying. So I want to ask, I'm sorry if you just covered this. You told me that if someone's driving along and they see, like if you see red tape on a vehicle, what does it mean?
Right. Especially in the wintertime or there's an accident and the troopers respond or the police respond and they investigate and we take the patient if there was a patient, or they just find it's an abandoned vehicle that ran off the road or is disabled. The troopers and the police will put red or yellow tape off the vehicle, on the doors or around the vehicle. And that just signifies that it's been checked, that it's empty. There's nobody hurt in the vehicle. So if you see that, those you don't need to call in if you see the red or yellow tape around the vehicle.
And also you were talking about people just driving by and calling and not stopping. There are Samaritan laws in the state, aren't there? Or does this not fall under that?
It doesn't. Samaritan laws basically provide people from immunity from liability if they stop and render aid. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you have to stop and render aid. The only law is if you're involved in the accident, you have to render aid as best you're able, if you're able to. You know, if you're injured yourself, you know, help yourself. But the law says that if you hit somebody and they're injured and you can help them, then you're required by law to offer whatever aid you can provide. But people don't have to stop, and sometimes they don't feel safe. It's a lonely part of the road, so they call 911 and report it.
And they could endanger themselves, too.
There's a possibility. You know, you got to watch for traffic.
you hear every year of responders even getting hit by cars passing emergency scenes. So that's another thing. You know, under state law, if you're past a emergency scene, slow down, pull over as much as you can, and go very slowly past the scene and pay attention to
and watch the road, not the right.
Watch the road, not the scene.
Not the jaws of life at work or whatever.
I've worked a lot of accidents, not in Homer, but in Oklahoma on highways and stuff where there's accidents that happen around us from people rubbernecking at the scene and get rear-ended or lose control and end up having another accident.
Trying to shoot a photograph.
Not so much then, but now, yeah,
now
everybody
yes.
wants to get a shot on their cell phone, unfortunately.
And while we're on this subject, what about the things that a person can do right now to protect their home or to make to prepare their home for any emergency or...
The absolute most important thing that people have to have in their house is a smoke detector. You know, make sure that it's got working batteries. We recommend changing if it has batteries, change the batteries every 6 months.
Well, our pattern used to be when the
change
clocks
your clock,
changed,
change your battery.
You guys would show up here at the coffee table and remind
right.
people. So if you can't remember the last time you changed the batteries, do it now.
Or now they have detectors that have 6-year batteries or 5-year batteries. So you don't have to check them, but you need to check and see that they still work. They
test
have
them.
Typically a test button that you can push if you can reach it. And just test them, make sure they work. Every sensor, whether it's a carbon monoxide detector, which is something else that you should have in your home if you burn wood or fuel of any kind, you need to have a carbon monoxide detector. It's not only a good idea that'll save your life, but it is state law that you have a working smoke detector and carbon monoxide detector.
And
now they're selling combined.
Oh, good. You definitely come across issues of carbon monoxide.
Absolutely. Every year we get calls for carbon monoxide alarms going off. Sometimes it's a false alarm. Sometimes it's a actual high concentration of carbon monoxide, and it kills people every winter, every year from high levels, whether it's from a failed chimney or a failed exhaust vent for a boiler or a stove. We get calls all the time. Fortunately, a lot of times it's just the sensor going bad on the piece of equipment. Every sensor has a lifespan. We recommend 7 to 10 years as a maximum lifespan for a smoke detector or a carbon monoxide detector. So you can take the thing off the wall, look at the back of it. It'll tell you the date of manufacture. If it's more than 7 years, probably time to replace it.
And what about... I want to hear about your relationships with the borough, because there are fire stations. There's McNeil, there's Diamond Ridge. The way that you guys cooperate with the borough, will they be involved in Saturday's drill?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a combined drill. The Borough Office of Emergency Management is participating. Both the Anchor Point Volunteer Fire Department, Kachemak Emergency Service Area, which are both borough fire department service areas, that are outside of Homer are participating. The Homer Volunteer Fire Department at one time covered basically everything south of Anchor Point. From Anchor Point, Midway Anchor Point, about the old Sterling to as far east end road as you wanted to go. In early 2000s, when the city went through the annexation, there was a group of people that decided they wanted local fire protection. Rather than relying on the city of Homer to provide that. So they established the Kachemak Emergency Service Area. And they built a station at McNeil Canyon, about 12 miles east end road. And about 2007, they went independent, and they are completely responsible now for their own fire and EMS protection. They used to contract with Homer for service until they got enough resources, personnel, and stuff to operate. So we have mutual aid agreements. We have automatic aid agreements with KISA. We have mutual aid agreements with Anchor Point that says if they have a fire or an EMS call that they need our help, they call us, we go if we're able to. Anchor Point and KISA are about the same. We ask for help, they ask for help. And the idea is that we provide what services we can provide to the community as a whole, as an entire community on the Lower Peninsula. Just to get people there and the resources there as quickly as possible.
Well, it's time to wrap up. So we do have one more caller. So let's see. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Kathleen.
Go ahead.
Yes, being a pilot of sorts, aircraft, I was just wondering if they have thought about, you know, what if a plane goes down, you know, on final approach in the water on the one end, or off there in by Stone Step Lake on the other end, you know, with the there's Coast Guard, Rescue 21 and Coast Guard, and I don't know who you'd find on four-wheelers on the other end.
Well, this gives us a really good opportunity to talk about Saturday's training. Can you talk? Can you address Jeff's concern?
I can tell you right, the airport does have an airport emergency plan, which does include water issues, ditchings or crashes in Mud Bay, which have occurred in the past, crashes in Beluga Lake. They do have a NIAID, a rigid hold inflatable, that they stage at the airport that they can trailer to either Beluga Lake or to the bay side if necessary. We also have you know, resources that we can provide. There's Rescue 21. In fact, we recently had a maritime response meeting that we held at the fire station to talk about near shore events that happen, what resources are immediately available. And we do have some deficiencies in near water or shallow water, because we do have some resources in the harbor, but as you
can
imagine...
Well, I saw you have on your list of equipment, you have a Zodiac?
We have a small inflatable with a shrouded propeller motor. We initially went with a jet drive, but we put it in the lake and it quickly filled up with vegetation and became useless. So we changed it out to a prop, and we do have a shroud around it to help protect somebody if they're in the water in case we do, you know, protect a leg or something from a moving propeller. It'll help protect that. But we do have an inflatable. The harbor has a harbor tug that has some firefighting capacity, but it's fairly slow, and it takes a while to get out of the harbor and around the end of the spit, either direction you go. So we recently acquired an Argo, which is an amphibian all-terrain vehicle, to replace an old six-wheel astride vehicle that pulled a rescue trailer that we could transport a lay-down supine patient on. The Argo is, you know, it's eight-wheel drive. It's an amphibian, so we can take it into water, and it does have the capacity to carry a stretcher patient. So if we have a beach issue or somebody near shore, we can get that hopefully to them a little bit better, especially in the boggy muskeg areas around the airport.
And what do you say, Jeff? Does that address your question?
Yeah, more than I thought.
That's why we love Chief Painter. Okay, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Kathleen, and thanks to Bob. I talked to him at one point when he called me on a Civil Air Patrol thing when I was a member there. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you.
So it's time to, I have on my list to talk about the building. Can you give us a short update on the fire building?
Sure. If you haven't noticed... you must not have driven past Pioneer recently, because you see a lot of activity going on at the fire station. We're undergoing, we started a couple of months ago, we're basically undergoing the largest renovation of the building since it was constructed and dedicated in 1980. So it's quite a lot going on. All of the floor finishes that were original to the building are being replaced. In fact, they were working on the downstairs floor, chipping it up from its original vinyl tile. And we've had the building almost completely painted inside. We've converted to natural gas, so we can save a lot on our electric bill. We were total electric heat until now, and we're converting to natural gas. We're updating the facility and doing a lot of things that deferred maintenance things in the building just to sustain it, to keep it alive for another 15, 20 years.
And finally, issuing a call for actors, for LARPers, for concerned citizens who want to participate in Saturday's drill. And what's the number? I've got the number here, 235-3155. Extension 1, call, because Chief Painter says 10 more volunteers are needed.
Yep, I probably have 5 calls
messages waiting for me when I get back to the station.
If we've done our job,
I will get a hold of everyone that's called in so far and be happy to take your calls the rest of the day. I'm in and out, so if I don't answer the phone, leave a message. I'll get back to you.
And if you have the strength, the wherewithal, the desire to serve in a greater capacity, firefighter training is starting.
Firefighter training starting in October 2nd. Get your applications in. Got an interview to go through, physical abilities test to just kind of test your some of that strength that we were talking about earlier. You don't have to be in peak physical condition.
Right.
But
you like running
able...
with a pack, with a 30-pound pack, and you have to run in a mile and under?
We don't run.
Okay.
That's one thing we don't. Firefighters do not run. We walk very fast, and we do have to carry loads. So that's what we check. Everything that, or all the physical ability things that we do are task-based, things that we would actually be doing on the fire ground.
Okay.
So that's what we test.
Is there anything you would like to say in closing?
No, I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to come in, update you on what's going on with the fire department and the classes and everything that's going on. Like I said, it's a busy summer.
Well, the pleasure is all ours. Chief Bob Painter from the Homer Volunteer Fire Department, thank you for being on Coffee Table.